I have the pleasure of introducing our own Stuart Goodnick. He is one of the founders of the store here, a teacher at Paiute Meditation Center, the owner and operator of Many Rivers Books and Tea. I've known Stuart now since 1985. It's too many years to count, so I won't bother to try, but he has been a Tayu practitioner since then and a Tayu teacher since 1993. He has also embodied the teaching in a variety of career choices, starting with house painting and continuing on to electronic technician, and now is vice president in a moderately large startup software company. So he has a lot to say about bringing the capital W work to work, to the workspace that that we all have some experience with in its various guises. I can't think of anyone better prepared to talk about this topic, in fact, than Stuart, so have at it.
Well, thank you very much. There's a number of different places I can start with this. I'll just start that since this is a small group, you know, I encourage lots of questions, and you know, let's make this something of a dialogue. But that way, I don't have to work so hard. Mm-hmm. But I'll start with a couple of vignettes, and I want to talk a little bit about my own career path, just to frame that with respect to spiritual practice. The vignette is that, as Rob mentioned, my official title is Vice President of Professional Services and Support for a software company that makes a security product. And one of our chief customers right now, both an investor in the company and a large customer, is Goldman Sachs. So that's a nice blue chip name. And that's afforded me recently, whether I wanted it or not, lots of trips to the East Coast. And I am often hanging out in a building on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River. It's the tallest building in New Jersey, I'm told. But it's right at the edge of the water, so it's almost like you're kind of, you'll fall over into Manhattan. And so the views out of this building, whether you're on the ground floor or the upper floors, is tremendous. You see Manhattan, you see the Statue of Liberty, you see Ellis Island. It's like this perfect location. And I was sitting down in the cafeteria with some people that I've been working with and some people from some other groups and having lunch. And the subject of our store came up, because now that we have online purchasing, I don't miss an opportunity to try to get people to buy tea from us. So I was describing the store, and then someone asked, you know, well, what about the spiritual side of it? And so I was describing the spiritual outreach of the store, and the fact that Many Rivers is a kind of a vehicle and was started by a meditation organization I'm a part of. And some people asked about that. And so I found myself all of a sudden in this context very naturally just going into a fairly, you know, detailed description of practices like self-observation. And there were some people that were, you know, really interested, but other people were really interested because it was so out of context for what, you know, people are usually talking about there. And then at one point, a woman is a vice president. She's in the IT group, who are the people I was hanging out with, asked, so how does this help your, you know, how have you found that all this helps your work life? And so it was an interesting question to me, because the way she was looking at it, or the way she was hearing what I was talking about, was that my spiritual practice could help me with my career. Or that was a natural conclusion that one draw, that the work that I do in practice, the work that I do with Tayu, is, you know, sharpens my career skills and makes me more effective in the workplace. And that was something that was of value for her. And the reason I bring that up is that if there's any point that I want to really ground into the ground here tonight, it's that it's actually the opposite relationship that is the one that we have the opportunity to establish, that is, that our workplace exists to serve our practice. And so that's a very important point. Excuse me a second. Sorry. Just a little humor. So our workplace can exist to serve our practice, and that means that our relationship to our workplace has to be different than the way that we normally are used to, or the way that we're often trained or brought up to relate to it. You know, for most of us, I think, in one form or another, you know, work is either a necessary evil in life where we have to make money in order to support other things that we do, or work in the workplace is a career that, because of education, because of a random walk in life, we find ourselves sort of accumulating a set of skills and interests, and then that kind of builds on itself, and we end up with finding kind of the universe moving us into this kind of this theater space where we become really consummate performers, and we have this career all of a sudden, and then that career builds momentum, and we start to think about the career and advance it forward. And so for some people, their identities and that which gives them meaning is found in their workplace. For other people, they work to fund those activities which give them meaning. And in both cases, though, the work environment is like the condition in which most of us as Americans end up spending the majority of our time. You know, when I think about the amount of time I spend in my professional existence, particularly right now because I'm working for an early stage company that's kind of at the stage in its existence where you're rubbing sticks together and trying to get sparks to light fires, that it consumes a lot of time. And because it consumes that kind of time, I sort of have this choice of, well, do I then do spiritual practice outside of that and have this small time slice, or do I try to turn that whole context into fuel for my practice? So that's the fundamental point about all of this, and it's a important point because so often today, when people look at spiritual practices, spiritual practices are kind of made enticing or sold to us because of the ways in which they can make the rest of our life more efficacious. And so I think even many of these books, which I'm happy for you to buy, have at least in part this idea that, you know, practice and focusing your attention and meditating and being grounded are all very useful skill sets for a very effective work environment. But for a genuine, to use the work environment as an engine for spiritual work requires that we surrender to the work environment in a very different way. So what do I mean by that? I mean that, I'll give you an example of how I sort of came to this opinion with my own original experiences. I moved up to Sonoma County to be involved with Hayu Center, and so at that point in my life I made a decision that I was going to be part of a spiritual school, and that was my intention. And so I needed, just because of the, you know, economics, I needed to have a job. As Rob mentioned, the first job I took was as a house painter because one of the Taiyu students at the time had a house painting business. I was not a great house painter, but it was good practice for me in the sense that I had just come out of a technical education, and so I had, you know, various degrees in physics, and, you know, was pretty much all in my head. So getting up on ladders and house painting, even not very particularly effectively, was good work. And that, in a fourth way sense, that constituted work because I was definitely moving against resistance in myself. But at some point, I needed to, you know, get a job, and I had this idea that I wanted to kind of you might say a Zen-like job in the sense that, you know, I wanted to have something that didn't require me to engage my mind that much, something I could just do that was not necessarily physical, but at least routine. And then, you know, I would have all my creative energy for the work I was doing with Taiyu Center. So I found a job with an electronics company in Roanoke Park as a repair technician. Roughly technical, you know, I had to know a little bit, but I didn't know anything about it. But they were sort of intrigued by my application because I was highly overqualified for the position. But I took it, and I was very happy for a while because I just was doing some very basic stuff, and I had a lot of time, and it seemed like my work was over here, my spiritual practice was over here. And then over time, the situation started to change, and I started to change in relation to it. I started to see in that space that things were arising, like desires were arising in me, like, oh, I wanted more responsibility, I wanted to do more things. And circumstances started to open up in that space where I got a promotion to an engineering group, and then that was kind of fun for a while because that was sort of more, you know, kind of matched to my skill set. But then after about a year and a half, my boss left the company, and I... in the kind of transition, because it was another kind of early stage company, I was able to become manager of this engineering group, and suddenly that position, unbeknownst to me, I just volunteered for it because our group didn't want to be absorbed by another engineering team. I volunteered, and I suddenly it turned out that this job reported to the general manager, and I was on the executive staff, and that wasn't something I planned. And then as part of that transition, I inherited an engineer that was probably quasi-bipolar, probably had bipolar disorder, where some days he would be really happy and other days he was incredibly angry. And suddenly I was just thrown into this situation. And I mention that, I'm going through all this story because my experience of all that at every time was that this was happening because I had given myself, or I had surrendered myself to the situation and established the relationship that whatever happened in this space, it was happening because I was asking the universe to provide me with food for my practice. And when you make that kind of declaration to the universe, when you open yourself to the universe in that way and say, I want to grow spiritually, what that means is that you, for that to really work, you have to surrender your right to pick and choose. You have to give up the right to make choices about what is right for you and what is wrong for you in a certain way. That doesn't mean that we don't have to act in certain situations because the nature of the situation requires a certain response, but it does mean that when I found myself in that situation, which was fairly overwhelming, I had to embrace it as fully as I possibly could. And so it's this embracing situations that arise in the contexts of our lives that is kind of the heart of this idea that I want to impart about what it means to turn your workplace into an engine for spiritual transformation. Because if we are so inclined, if we are willing to take that step and turn ourselves to the universe open-heartedly, nakedly as it were, and say that, yes, I want to grow, I want to transform, I surrender myself to the universe, that action creates necessarily a reciprocal response in the universe. It's something of a mystery because we can't predict it. But my claim, and this is a claim that I invite you all to test or to reflect upon in your own experiences, but my claim is that the universe is lawfully bound to respond by starting to provide circumstances that push buttons, keep you a little bit off of the comfort zone, challenge you in ways that are of relevance to things you may be working on in your spiritual practice. The important thing about this, though, is I want to go back to this point of giving up picking and choosing, because to turn the workplace into an engine of spiritual transformation means that you have to keep enhancing this effect, and that means that everything that comes at you, you have to embrace more fully. You have to, even if it's like difficult conversations, difficult people that you work with, you know, you move closer to all of those things as opposed to distancing yourself and trying to control the situation. And when you do that, then the universe gives you more. If the moment you turn away and say, that's enough, or that's not right, or I know better, then the process starts to break down and dry up, as it were. And so we have to actively keep that knowingness in mind, that whatever is happening, it's meaningful. Whatever is happening, it has meaning for my practice in this moment now, and I need to embrace it with full attention. Embracing it with full attention doesn't mean that we're rugs and we, you know, let the universe roll over us or anything like that. Embracing it with full attention means that we move towards that which is uncomfortable. Many of you have heard me use the phrase, follow your dread. I find dread in the workplace is wonderful, but dread in the workplace isn't like, you know, like having difficult encounters with people. Dread in the workplace is something as small as picking up the phone and making a cold call if you're in a sales context, knowing that 90% of the time the person on the other end is going to get you off the phone as fast as possible. I mean, that even that creates resistance in us. But then there are times where we have to have to deal with people who annoy the heck out of us, people who are in this workplace that we wouldn't hang out with. And we certainly would arrange our lives to avoid them normally, but the work environment is like this perfect crucible. Here's all these people, and we can move closer to them and see all the things in ourselves get called up, and that provides us with raw material for our work. I haven't talked a lot at this point about what you do with all of that. I'm more sort of setting the stage. But at this point, I'm just curious if there's any questions or comments.
Yeah. Moving toward your dread is sort of like using a detector to find out, okay, you're scanning the world to see where you're going to put your attention.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you move equally towards things which you are positively or enthusiastically attracted to.
Well, the idea of following your dread the reason why I use that formulation is that we don't need any coaching in terms of moving towards things that we're attracted to.
I think we do, but that's another.
We'll take that. I mean that's fair, and we can explore that. But following your dread is more about areas where there are resistance in our conditioning that block us from admitting to or embracing or allowing or feeling free within certain circumstances. So it might be a person. It might be someone who really annoys you and you feel like you want to say something, but you don't know what to say and how to say it. So moving towards that situation is moving towards an area that stirs a bunch of things up. And when we talk fourth way about the way that we are organized as beings, the fourth way has a model. It's like all models, you know, take it with a bit of a grain of salt, but it's a working model that as organisms we're composed of three centers. We have a body or moving center, we have an emotional center, and we have a mental center. And in this model, each of these centers are sort of independently conditioned and function through the process of association and reactivity with the external world somewhat independently. And there are these loose couplings that are between these centers, so that what that means in our lives, for the most part, is that our day-to-day existence is very reactive. That is, situations come up, someone says something, you see something, you're reminded of something, you feel something, you're in a particular posture, And that engenders a set of associations independently in each of these centers, and we interpret that as a spontaneous psychological experience. Yes?
What came up for me when you said follow your dread and your response to that, for me it felt more like it's not following either one, it's following whatever arises and staying open in the moment of whatever is being presented. Mm-hmm. So rather than naming a dread or a pleasure or whatever, it's whatever is in front of you and staying open to that.
Yes, I would agree with that. And the reason that we talk about following your dread is that the model I was describing about our automatic associations and the way that we often are not really open to things, but sort of our inner experience is somewhat conditioned by thoughts that we're used to having, feelings that we're used to having, and sensations we're used to feeling, that sometimes these habit patterns keep us under kind of narrow channels of expression and experience. And so the boundaries of these habit patterns are usually, in a subjective interior way, found at the frontiers of dread or frontiers of fear. And so following your dread is more of a device. It's not an absolute thing, because what you're saying I agree with, but it's more of a practical tool that we can use to test where we may be unconsciously keeping ourselves from opening up to. So in any sort of situation, when you say open yourself to what's there, there will be resistance from our conditioning about opening to what's there. The nature of that resistance often takes the form of discomfort or dread. There's lots of other ways in which we realize resistance too, but we've just found it's a simple phrase, so it's easy to remember, but it's a way of moving towards the things that we are contracting most against. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In the work that I'm doing, which is organization development,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is kind of an innate need almost to really what we call, you know, be the instrument to what you're doing. You know, be self as instrument,
mm-hmm.
in a way. So it's in any situation, especially when it is uncomfortable, you know, to be really aware of that and moving towards that, you know, because that's the work that we're doing, is mm-hmm. to really be able to guide that and facilitate that and be transparent enough to, you know, to help the client
mm-hmm.
move through that as well.
Right. Yeah. And the in what we do with, you know, in the framework of our practice, the Tayu practice is similar to the fourth wave practices, which some of you may know of, but one of the key practices that we engage in is self-observation. And self-observation is, it's not about self-analysis, and our aim is not to fix ourselves. Our aim is to be present in a way to what is happening so that we can inhabit the organism that we find ourselves in as fully as possible. And so when we practice self-observation, we are opening ourselves and seeing, in a way, everything that arises in this organism. So we see the sensations, we see the feelings, we see the thoughts, and we see the exterior situation, all from a place of non-judgment, non-identification, non-action in a sense, because we're not trying to change anything. And that's a fundamental function of one stage of this kind of practice, because when we have the spaciousness to see in this way, we can then open ourselves more fully to what is actually happening. And whatever context we find ourselves in, that context then can speak to us in a way, because the context begins to pull things and cause things to arise in this organism that we're able to see and to see clearly. The act of seeing partly transforms it, but in a way it's not, that's almost not the point. It doesn't matter what the details are. And that's, and I this is getting a little abstract, to bring it back to a work situation. When we're engaged in spiritual practice within a work context, our focus of attention and our primary aim is to cultivate spiritual presence through the practice and through being in that situation as fully as possible. It's not to get the next promotion, or it's not to achieve a particular end. And if our focus is on the details of the dream, as it were, then we get, that becomes a kind of a shunt or a diversion that takes energy away from this practice that I'm talking about. More questions or comments?
I have a comment is back on my other point that I introduced a moment ago about, and the reason I introduced it was because I believe I go just as unconscious in moving towards an attraction, just as unconscious as I do when I'm shunning something which I want to stay away from.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's an even greater challenge, I think, when I'm moving in a pleasurable direction to maintain awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Then it often a challenge will be so challenging that I'll be stuck and I'll be reminded to take stock. But when I'm pell-mell after that strawberry ice cream cone or that woman on the corner or whatever it is, then I can just dive right into an old pattern without much awareness.
Right. That's a great point. I mean, that's what you're describing has certainly been true in my experience. And, you know, I don't, as I said, that following your dread is sort of a device for a certain kind of work. But what you're describing there is in some ways more challenging because it's very easy to get lost in the identification or get lost in that. So when we start this kind of work or start this kind of practice, we begin and focus on establishing a presence in ourselves with this self-observation practice that I described. And part of the practice of self-observation involves returning to the body. I don't want to over-dramatize that because sometimes that's almost become a cliche in spiritual discussions now. But when we return to the body, that's sort of a starting point of just feeling the presence of sensation. And when we're able to be present with sensation in our body and just be there with that, that starts to help to develop a stability which allows us to be present to more other varieties of experience in this three-centered organism I'm describing. So we can be present to the play of what we think are emotions in ourselves. We can be present to a train of association without necessarily getting stuck on the train. You know, sometimes we can take a step off and stand on the platform and watch the train go by. And when we're able to do those sorts of things, then we establish this space in which we can open ourselves more fully to things that are happening. And, you know, I go back to the workspace. This talk it has just as easily been about bringing the work to the kitchen or, you know, to the, you know, taking out the garbage. But we spend so much time in our professional existence that it's a useful reminder that there's no reason why you can't do this kind of practice fully and with dedicated intensity in the middle of Goldman Sachs, you know, in the looking out over Manhattan. There's no reason why you can't. And yet, there are unique challenges to trying to bring practice into these well-worn habit patterns that are often associated with our workspace. And that's one of the big challenges, and that's why, in and of itself, I haven't found it possible to do that on one's own, in the sense that if you I can even give an example. I was at a study group with some of our students in San Francisco this week, and one of the things that we've been doing is working on some basic, you might call them tasks of attention, you know, where each week there'll be some task of attention or sort of an exercise where we'll work on something and just talk about the experience. And several people, particularly the ones who were deeply enmeshed in professional existence, didn't have time for it or didn't make space for that. And that's not unusual. I mean, in some respects, the purpose of trying to do tasks is to demonstrate to oneself actually how difficult doing something outside of the well-worn habit patterns really is. But it also reminded me that it's really hard without some sort of like plugging into a tradition, a practice, a sangha, a group of people that are engaged in this kind of work. It's really hard to do this sort of thing on your own because the power of the habit patterns and the power of the environment is very strong. You know, like a workspace has lots of people who are working through very focused habit patterns, all for an aim that has nothing to do with one's spiritual practice. It's all to do, you know, do whatever the job or the business or the situation we're in is about. And so it's almost impossible not to get caught up in that. But as long as we have some way of throwing some lifelines out or keeping some buoys out that are floating on the waters of spiritual attention, we can keep what we call reminding factors active so that we have the possibility of returning to the place of this perspective of awareness, particularly in the early stages. But it's very challenging. And so, you know, even though it's, you know, it almost, you know, it sounds like I was very obvious about bringing spiritual practice in the workplace, and I'm describing a way of doing that. The hard thing is that there's really powerful forces of habit energy that everyone is engaged in and radiating out that make it very, very challenging to actually maintain this kind of presence. But it's for that reason that if we make efforts in that direction, that the work environment, the day job, as it were, can become all that more effective for us. Because if we can create that opening and surrender ourselves and broaden our presence and our ability to accept what's happening and to observe all the things that arise in us as we engage in this environment, there's the opportunity for developing more quickly a kind of depth and a kind of presence than you might get in lots of other situations, because there's powerful forces at work. And if you can use those forces for food for your practice, there's more energy available. But of course, it's like, you know, sort of like whitewater rafting or something like that. It's thrilling and, you know, exhilarating, but it's also dangerous. And dangerous in the sense that it's easy to become very identified. And even in my own work, I found ways in which I became identified. There came a point for me where, long after I was the electronic technician, just humbly, you know, soldering my resistors and integrated circuits onto broken circuit boards, that I started to take my professional existence seriously. I started to identify with the role, you know, and then that exposed all sorts of interesting realms of work for me, which actually took me many years to move through. Realms of work in terms of habit patterns of how I wanted attention from my boss, and how I wanted it but didn't want to be clear about what I wanted. And in one case, that all sort of culminated in me finding an excuse to leave a company and going to another company, only to recreate the same situation with different people until I really had to deal with it. And then once I dealt with it, the situation changed, and I went into another company and had just a completely opposite experience, because that was no longer an issue. But that sort of thing happens. You can't run away from it. These patterns will continue to reassert themselves unless you take them head on and kind of move through them. Some more questions?
Gurdjieff is famous for having said that it's a good idea to try to make your living with your left big toe in order to have all this other time for, quote, real work. And of course, you're saying something, it sounds like, very different to me. Do you want to comment on that?
You're a good plant. That's an interesting comment, because Gurdjieff did advise people that make your living with your left toe, so that doesn't consume you, and then you can spend time engaged in your real work. And in a sense, I'm saying something. I'm saying something different in that I'm suggesting that it's possible to if your aim is to do work on yourself, and that is your true aim, then it's possible for that aim to condition the circumstances you're in to support your work. And it's maybe a peculiarly American thing, because we seem to have the condition where we have to work in some form or another. So it's making a virtue out of necessity. But I've certainly found that as long as I maintain the attitude of that whatever the universe is providing is what I'm supposed to be working on, that, you know, the situation just kind of unfolds and I move with it without trying to change it, except to respond to it and be present as is natural and as it arises naturally in myself to respond to it. What I mean by that is, As I said earlier, I'm not talking about rolling over and letting the circumstances just kind of roll over you. There's within oneself, you'll know at some level, or have the possibility of knowing, when sometimes you have to do certain things. Like, I've had situations where my mechanical instinct, when sort of an injustice was done to me by a boss, would be to just not let it bother me, like, I'll just go with that, I won't deal with it. But the thing that I dreaded was actually confronting it. And so that's another, kind of an example of what I mean by following your dread. I could see that what I was avoiding was the need to actually truly confront the situation and in a sense have a showdown, because that was every habit pattern I've affected since I was a child is all about how to get along and get out of the way and not create problems. So my work in that moment then became to have such a showdown. And doing that represented a huge energetic shift in my organism, because I intentionally moved through something that I had a tremendous amount of resistance in. That doesn't mean that all things became perfect by any means, but it's that shift was presented by the situation, and so I was surrendering to the situation, because in that situation it became absolutely clear that this is the thing to be done. And so in our work lives, when we surrender in this way, we're not giving up our responsibility. We have a responsibility to be true to ourselves in the situation. And we might make mistakes. We might do something that may be a product of a mechanical reaction or a mechanical identification, in which case we embrace the consequences, and the consequences will be as instructive as the situation. In other cases, we have to do something that's against our habitual grain and essentially jump off the diving board and make ourselves vulnerable. Make ourselves vulnerable to the unknown. That's really what we're talking about in this situation, is that what we dread most typically is to jump off into life and make ourselves vulnerable to that which we can't control. Whereas all of our habit patterns, particularly in a work place is all about CYA. You know, cover your anterior and make sure that you're safe and you've got everything in control. So when you take those moments and actually dive into the unknown, those are the moments of truth, and those are the moments where transformation is often most readily found. Yeah.
It would strike me that the spiritual endeavor is not a part-time or a left toe process. It's in terms of you don't do it when you're working, you do it at some other time. That does not strike me as a spiritual endeavor. And to go back to the statement that you made earlier about you've given up picking and choosing, if you're engaged in spirituality and that's really what you've decided to do, you have to do it at work. You don't have any choice. You've given up your choice over that.
Right. I agree. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about here. You don't have a choice, and the question that we all have to ask ourselves is the degree to which that we've made that commitment, that our spiritual path trumps everything in our lives, and everything in our lives feeds that and supports that, but our spiritual path and our spiritual work is senior to all of that. And that's a useful thing to a useful mirror to look at, I find, because then all these questions become very simple. Because when you do that, then no matter where you are, you're practicing, or no matter where you are, the potential for practice is there. But a lot of times, you know, particularly in early stages for folks encountering spiritual work, there's a tendency to do like we do with other things and to relate to spiritual practice as a kind of an avocation or a hobby, or I do this on, you know, I go to this class, or I go to this talk on these days, I go to this meditation group on these days, and then, you know, I go to my drawing class on these days or my poetry class. And what we're talking about here is exactly what you're saying, that there is a radically different relationship we have to take to our spiritual life, our spiritual dimension, in order to turn the engine of the material world into service for that practice. So either we're serving the material world by, you know, fulfilling a role in the great mystery of nature, and nature uses material matter in all sorts of creative ways and transforms energy from one state to another state, or we turn that whole engine into service for our spiritual work, but we do that by surrendering to that very thing and starting to embrace it and to allow our lives to become a conversation with the events in our lives in such a way that we can look at ourselves and see ourselves more clearly. And in that looking, begin to cultivate this presence that I was talking about earlier. Yes.
Do you see a fundamental difference between what you're calling material and spiritual?
I would say there's a difference. I mean, fundamental, that's a tricky word. And
beyond appearances.
Yeah. So I would say that there's a truth that's beyond appearances. There's a truth beyond the phenomenal realm. We sometimes use the term non-phenomenal to describe our that aspect of ourselves that's behind the exterior manifestation. And it's, you know, to say that there's a the idea that there's a distinction is a relative thing. You know, it might be useful for creating a context for a particular work or practice, but ultimately, I would say there is no distinction in an ultimate sense. But what does that mean? You know, it's very easy to, you know, logically one can say, oh, everything's one. Practically, we find ourselves exteriorized and reacting to an exterior environment, and we have to come to terms with that.
I guess for me, it's, and I'm just exploring this idea now a little bit, but it's kind of like spiritual and material are categories that lose their boundaries for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think of anything that I do or anything that I am or anything that anybody else or anything does or is that isn't fundamentally all part of this same soup called spiritual. I'm going to call it spiritual for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's manifest or unmanifest, it's everything. And I think I'm kind of incapable, although I can get myself to a frame of mind. Oh, I know what you're talking about when you're saying spiritual, and I'm not referring to you, but to someone else, mm-hmm. but for tonight, I feel that what you're talking about when you say spiritual is really quite close to my definition that sort of says, well, it's everything. That there really isn't a separation between the spiritual and the mundane, if we want to call it that, the 3D apparent world.
Right. Well, I I'm a big advocate of that in the particular sense that for the purpose of our discussion tonight, that the mundane world, which often it's, you know, it's Monday morning going to the job is as mundane as it gets for many people, that there is no separation, that any separation that we create is another habit pattern that we're creating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, that's, I agree with that. I think what I'm also saying, though, and I'm making a somewhat stronger statement, is that we can do something at a non-phenomenal level, which allows us to sort of turn the phenomenal realm into something that sort of speaks back to us and cultivates greater presence in the non-phenomenal. And it's by turning what we have the capability of doing at a spiritual, quote-unquote spiritual level is deciding where we put our attention. You know, if there's not a lot else out in the material realm that we may be capable of doing because we don't know where we're programmed by whatever sets of experiences and whatever genes we have and whatever accidents of our lives have programmed us to react in certain ways. But we have some choice about where we turn our attention. And if we turn our attention back onto the nature of our presence in phenomena, we can start to change the dynamic and the subjective experience of our presence in this realm. And that's something that, you know, so I'm describing that as what spiritual practice is. It's the turning of our attention in a different direction. Whereas in ordinary unconscious life, our attention is riveted and hypnotized by the internal associations of the mental, emotional, and physical center. And we live a life that's a dream with all these goals and ambitions and things like that, which ultimately are simply our attention being fixated on the exterior play or the exterior drama. So taking that act of will to turn our attention in a different direction, to pull our attention back from the things that we normally find ourselves identified with, to explore an identity that transcends any particular formal realization is part of the work of spiritual practice.
Seems that some of the things that maybe we do, I haven't heard you play the flute, but I wasn't here that night, but some of the things that we do that maybe are out of band, maybe inform, I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, we have this idea of a job as kind of this, well, mundane task, but to the extent that we really, I'm thinking, like, maybe, I think it was Isadora Duncan, the modern dance notion that when you hear a note, you move in a certain direction, and you trust that movement. And so it's, and that doesn't necessarily say that it doesn't take effort to do that. And I mean, I'm thinking of you in that situation where you're talking about pointing to the website and talking about meditation, which is your, the life, your spiritual life infuses your work life. And it seems that it, it becomes more spacious. And, you know, your work world becomes more enjoyable. Because you're able to be free, you have the confidence to be able to say things like that in a group where one of the answers I thought you might say, that IT person maybe thought, well, Stuart, you're not focused on the task at hand. You know, I want to hear something technical. I don't want to hear something that, you know, maybe means you're distracted. But you have the confidence to, and in that setting, you know, maybe that's what that IT director actually needed. And so there's, I guess I'm just, you know, I guess the work world gets more fun as we go along if we stay open to, you know, that which is before us. In a certain, you know, recently I'm trying to come up with an information portal for energy efficiency. And what I found myself doing is walking around precincts in Sebastopol in support of a fifth district supervisor. And my introverted self found it very difficult to go and talk to people on a door-to-door basis. And yet, kind of thinking that, you know, that this is a friendly universe that we live in, what I found was that I was rewarded with having people who were talking about things that it turned out to be very interesting conversations. And where that heads, you know, in terms of, you know, where that technical challenge is ahead of me, I don't know. But these things kind of blur. I think that, that, you know, our fun world, the things that we like to do, this, you know, the path, the kind of things that we tend to want to go to easily, they all kind of, somehow there's this, you know, this symphony, or kind of a tapestry of things that, if we look at them,
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You raise a good point. I've been focusing on work in one sense from a practice point of view. But one of the metaphors, it's interesting that you use the term, reference to my playing my flute, because the metaphor that I would say when we find ourselves free in a work situation, or whatever situation, but we'll just focus on a work situation, I find it's more like being in a orchestra, and we're each playing an instrument, and we have a responsibility to the sound that the group is making. We have a responsibility to know what notes we're producing, and we have a responsibility to listen to the music coming from the other performers. So in the case that you're describing, or that I was describing about the IT woman and the conversation, I was practicing trying to listen to know, you know, how much is enough to say before that becomes a, before I start to actually turn someone off, as opposed to open someone in that way. And so in that sense, the, but when I say I was trying to do that, it wasn't that I was mentally processing that, but it's more like when you're playing, you're open to, you're just feeling the movement of the situation. And to the extent that we can feel the movement of a situation like that and know what is the right thing to do, even if you're in a business meeting, you know, and everyone's talking back and forth and all this sort of stuff, you can be present to that, participate with that, and yet it will have the quality of a dance. It'll have the quality of a of fun, as you say, because there's a lightness. The moment that it becomes heavy, well, you got something to look at. Just like you were describing that when the this fear of like knocking on someone's door and you know, pitching an idea is causes a an emotional center response or a cramp to come up. And you know, from a practice point of place, we just can put full attention on that and keep moving forward. And that moments like that, you know, will shift and the energy will shift, and we do that enough and then that habit pattern begins to change. We don't have to make it change in a particular direction. All we're really trying to do is to be better musicians in our lives or better dancers in our lives. And that's one of the consequences of what we're talking about here. It's I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the lighter side of this kind of focus, that the aim ultimately, or the subjective experience when we can be in a situation and surrender to it fully, is like dancing. It's like floating. It's fun and it's light. And in that place, the details tend to take care of themselves. You don't have to worry when a situation comes up that's a challenge. It's like, oh, this situation's come up and it's a challenge, so now I have to respond to that. And it's interesting to see other people, you know, it's sort of watching the stock market or something. When situations go up, everyone's happy. Situations become a challenge. People get depressed. And yet it's possible to do neither of those extremes, but to just be in this place in the middle of all that, which is do what's required when the situation calls it. You know, you can enjoy it when things are good and be focused when things are challenging, but for the you that's experiencing that, you're in a completely different place, because that's all sort of out there, and the dance is going on in here. Thank you.
The thing that strikes me about one of the major areas that's an obstacle for people in the work world isn't so much the work that people do, although that arises, it's the relationships that we have with other people in the work world that is usually the issue. Now, sometimes that's the sort of example where you were just giving about your relationship with bosses and recreating certain relationships with bosses until you learn to work through that. But in other cases, it might be, and I'm talking about my own experience here, is having it be hard to let myself be open to a suggestion from a boss or someone else who knows more about how to do something right or better or more efficiently, because I'm contracted around and grasping onto a particular identification of this is how I do this, or something along those lines. So I wondered if you would comment on that.
Well, I think you cover that fairly well. That the habit patterns that come up in a work environment are run a range of different kinds of things. What you're describing is, you know, our willingness to hear other people, our willingness to actually be wrong, or our willingness to be open to letting someone else tell us what to do, and whether we open to that and just let that go through us, or whether we kind of might act at the surface that we're going to do it and then make snide comments all the way or something like that. So these situations, when we are in a workspace like we've been talking about, depending on what goes on, you know, we may find ourselves contracting around, you know, someone who's telling us what to do, and we don't want to hear it. We might, and in that case, we want to look at that, and we want, you know, the first and foremost, we just want to see that process happening, and to see it from a place where there's enough presence and enough spaciousness that at some point we may not have to always reactively defend against the person who's trying to tell us something. And when we do that and we can change the habit a little bit as an experiment, then we might find that there's a something different happens, or there's a shift that happens. I certainly have had my own experiences of that sort of thing, where I've had people, colleagues, who had their own habit patterns of wanting to, you know, tell me why I was wrong and things that I was doing, and they were being fairly compulsive about it, but it pressed buttons in me, and it was really wonderful to see, because these things would come up really strongly. You know, like I get into one of these wonderful manic, you know, thought trains about how annoying this person was, or what do I do, or how do I respond to this. And so I, as a practice, I just tried to move towards that and let it in, like you're describing. Let that energy in, feel it, and then, you know, craft a response, or allow a response to emerge. And I found by doing that I could the person was still annoying, but I was able to not, you know, the annoyance would, I'd get annoyed briefly and then it would kind of die out, and then I would respond, as opposed to getting annoyed and then being annoyed for the next week, which is what typically happens with these sorts of things. So, you know, the way I would put it, and it's kind of part and parcel of some of the readings we've been doing recently, one of the arts that we find in this way of embracing the situations that come up that press our buttons in the workplace is to become transparent to that energy that comes in. And so part of the practice is to learn to be transparent, to let this stuff come in, and to see it come in, and to see that it's going to all the places, and there are all the invitations that are available for us to react in the ways that we've habitually reacted, but to have the possibility of not having to do that, and just to let that go through. And so when you can become transparent in situations, then, as you were describing, the situation becomes much more like a dance, because even the most annoying person or situation will be more like a kettle drum being beaten, as opposed to this attack on your the nature of your existence. It's like it just becomes a loud sound that you reverberate with, and then it dies out, and you continue to move on with the music making. So in our practice, when we've I'm talking about the ideal place that we may find ourselves in. When we don't find ourselves in those places, then there's just an opportunity of looking more clearly at the condition that's arising in ourselves and putting full attention on that and embracing that, not trying to change it, but just to see, oh, that's what's happening. You know, I'm getting really upset when this person tells me for the 14th time that I didn't do such and such the right way. And when that keeps coming up and we see that more clearly enough, that we create space around it in a natural way. We don't have to change it. We don't have to make it go away. We simply grow larger than that habit pattern. And it's in that growing larger than that habit pattern that we do what we say is cultivating presence. And when we cultivate presence in this way, we become bigger than any of these situations. And when you see people who are bigger than situations, like in the work world, these are the people that seem to, like nothing seems to bother them. They're able to intentionally maintain a tone of energy and maybe be a positive energy source and always bounce back from whatever situation happens, because they're bigger than the situation, because there is some cultivation of presence beyond the mechanical reactions that we initially start this process in. Yeah.
You mentioned about traveling. You're doing a lot of traveling right now, and I just talked a couple of days ago. I talked to someone who I may be an employment partner with soon, and he was complaining that he's had to do a lot of travel, Calgary, Atlanta, and he was, he wants to slow it down. How do you, and I'm curious about this just because travel is something that's sometimes problematic, airports and cramped airplanes, and how do you, because this is part of our work world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm just wondering, how do you, just to talk about that briefly, because it might help me. That's not just because I'm wanting to throw something out there, because I'm in that position sometimes. Where
right.
I've been in that situation many times, but
Well, yeah.
You're both tall.
Yeah.
Those little cramped airlines.
And it might not just be the cramped seat. making that flight, the anxiety of making the flight, when you just wanted to stay at home another 5 minutes and the whole series all the way to
right.
to the other end.
I'm still working that one, and I suspect that part of my excessive travel schedule is partly because I'm supposed to figure this one out. Rob has been very generous in his pointing out to me the degree to which I have strong habit patterns around this kind of compulsive mode of trying to make, get to the airport on time and all this sort of thing. Sometimes I've found where either I leave enough time where I can do something different, and just be completely relaxed. It's a very different kind of experience. And yet even then, there's a strong compulsive need to control the universe. What if I am late? What if I miss my flight? It's a funny thing to look at, and it is one that I still work on a lot, or still look at. I don't know if because it's very goal-oriented, and you're subject to forces larger than yourself, and there's strong consequences if you miss the flight, because it really throws your schedule into a disarray. And there's a whole sort of, for me, kind of macho thing about being on time and not being late no matter what. I don't know if I have great advice on that yet.
I mean, just to talk about it is good, because it's just, I don't know, there's value in just hearing that as a process.
Yeah, it's the challenge, I think it's what I look for in myself is to find a place where I have objective information on when I need to rush and when I don't.
Right.
And that's probably, there's still a balance there. I'm still working on that balance. Sometimes I find it, sometimes I don't. If I'm taking a cab from, one part of the city to get to the airport, I've found sometimes that there's this really strong habit pattern of being anxious. Other times I'm able to just surrender to the situation and let whatever happens. But it's work. And the best thing that we can do is, it's not a problem that we really have to solve, actually.
Right.
The nice thing about it is, and the way that we can use these habit patterns that we're talking about is, besides just embracing what the exterior world presents us, it's important to have that same quality of embracing the interior world. So that neurotic, cramp that arises, you should love it. Mm-hmm. But what loving it means is putting full attention on it, not trying to change it, because you don't change the thing you love. You just see it fully for what it is. And if the degree that we can see it and actually love the fact that you're getting this great look at this neurotic cramp that's that you've had, and every time you step into an airport, then that's all we need to do. The details will kind of take care of themselves. We don't have to fix anything or change anything.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with that. I guess I've evolved, and it speaks to what Rob said, many months ago about, to the extent that we can find peace, in some, or this is my interpretation of what I was hearing Rob say, but it, we have to be able to have that balance no matter what the pace is. Mm-hmm. And there can be that illusion, that appearance of changedness, of things, of having to get to places, and yet really that's just kind of it's just data, it's just information, and there's really no reason to get wrapped around the axle over it. Just because we see departure times and arrival times, it's just the stage that we're on. And there's always opportunities for fun things there too. That person that we meet, or that moment that's so different than, so out of what our normal everyday existence is, it actually can be kind of an exciting thing. We're open to it.
Right. Airports are actually these interesting adventures. There's all these different people, and there's all these different situations, and most of the people are in the same state that we're talking about, this very anxious, focused place. And so it's similar to the workplace. There's all these people in the, just trying to get by and try, all these different types and all these different sets of habits and personalities. And so it's wonderful because we rub up against all those differences. And when we rub against those differences, then that friction, stirs things up in ourselves, and that gives us the opportunity to embrace that which is arising. And that's a important piece of this. I'll emphasize this point again, that because we've been talking in and around, this hasn't been a nuts and bolts kind of discussion, because we're not talking about specific practices beyond just self-observation. But, it's important to always keep in mind that when we engage in this kind of work of bringing our attention, bringing the non-phenomenal attention onto the phenomenal manifestation, that we're not trying to change anything, because the details do not matter. The details... the particular manifest details are not as important as the act of turning that attention onto ourselves. And the analogy I find most useful is that in terms of growing spiritually, it's more like we have a seed, and with our attention, we can provide it with the conditions necessary for it to grow. But we don't have to determine how it grows. We don't have to figure out, where the shoots break off, and we don't have to figure out what the form is or anything like that. All we have to do is maintain those conditions, and the non-phenomenal attention and the presence that we bring to whatever our condition is the necessary condition to allow this growth to take place. Similarly, bringing that attention to the world outside of us in the way that we've been talking about is what allows the universe then to respond back to us and help us in that process. And in that sense, then, there isn't that any separation. We don't experience a separation because whatever happens is effectively, God speaking to us or speaking through us and helping in this process of growth. And I find that useful because it sort of takes, then what I have to do is fairly simple. I can turn my attention in a certain way. I don't have to worry the details, and that's a release of a great burden because we don't have to figure it all out. All we have to do is enjoy the process as it unfolds.
I think I'm wanting to make some kind of a, that the universe loves us. Because that's something I have to go to sometimes, is that the universe loves me just the way that I am right now in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of takes me off the hook sometimes when mm-hmm. I'm trying to see if something's
Well, yeah, and exactly. That's when we talk about turning attention on ourselves and embracing fully what's arising. That is the willingness to look. The willingness to look at ourselves, the willingness to look at another, is the act of love. That is love in manifestation, and that's the beginning. All the actions and all the phenomenal manifestations of that are follow from that willingness. And so, looking at ourselves, looking at others, is all part and parcel of the same thing. Love is a useful word to use for that, but it's also kind of an overloaded word these days. So, So it's fine to use that word, but it's more important to experience it directly, and then the vocabulary is less critical. How are we doing on time?
8:50.
Okay. Time for another question. One more question. Not a question, then I can do my sales pitch. So the analogy that I used about putting attention on oneself and not having to worry about the details is an analogy that's similar to planting a seed and allowing a plant to grow. So we have here to help recapitulate that and to give you a pleasant memory of this discussion, we have these Grow a Tree kits available. They're only like $6 to $8, so they're really cheap. They're great presents, but you can grow a ponderosa pine or an ancient bristlecone pine, Colorado blue spruce, and all you have to do is plant the seed and then provide the appropriate conditions for its growth, and then you will have an amazing tree that will last a very, very long time.
We don't have to figure out how it grows.
You can as a side project. And I know that you would probably enjoy that. But it's not necessary for the tree to grow.
Gee, how long does it take to grow a 4,000-year-old?
Well, you might find a way to accelerate its growth.
You better start right away.
Yeah.
Don't delay, buy one tonight.
Right.
When you come back next time, it will still be growing.
That's true. Well, we laugh.
You're the tree with no me.
When we moved into our house 20 years ago, right before we closed on the house, our escrow had finished, we had a living Christmas tree, and we planted it in the backyard. And 20 years is a long time for, this was like the messy pine tree, so now it's huge. And it's amazing to me, because at the time we planted it, I thought, oh, this thing's never going to grow. Or, so you just never know.
Yeah.
4,000 years may turn out to be, you can just go by it like that. And think of all the rings. Well, thank you very much. This has been a very enjoyable discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.